Will, it's great to see you, mate. I've heard a lot about you through Sam. Obviously, you work with Sam a lot. Before we get started, mate, I want to go into your career. You're the first rugby player we've had on. You've had a really interesting journey. We've just spoke off camera. Just tell me a bit about your life right now. I know you're in the same position as me and you're about to become a dad. So what does life look like right now for you?
Literally, everything is preparing for the unknown. It literally is. Background experience, I'm a strength and conditioning coach, worked in the peak performance space, worked with athletes, but mainly work with sort of the executive and corporate athlete vibe. Now, I also do coach education. I've just literally come back from Saudi Arabia coaching at Core Riyadh to their management team and their gym team, all around professionalism, leadership. I'm sort of like high performance culture is sort of where I've been. Education wise, master's degree in coaching, strength and conditioning degree. I've spent over $100,000 on extracurricular education for PT.
Wow.
I've been in the game for 16 years. As I said before, I'm 35, but I look 45, just weathered, long paper round. And then we've been in Manchester for 2 years since coming back from Singapore.
How has it changed? Finding out that you were going to be a dad, mate, how has that changed kind of like your outlook? For me, it's had quite a big impact straight away. I think a lot of the small problems I have in my life seem very insignificant now.
Yeah.
And they just kind of melted away.
Yeah.
And I think that's just only going to increase as soon as he comes and I get to meet him and he comes into the world. And I also feel a lot more motivated as well. It's great. It's like having a superpower.
Extra driver. Yeah,
big time. Like, as soon as January started, I've kind of hit the ground running and...
Get attacking.
Yeah, and I think those situations where I maybe, if it was just for me, I'd be kind of sat on the fence a bit. Now I'm like, no, I just go straight for it. You know,
massive.
I had a conversation yesterday. There was a school that approached me about doing some work later in the year, and the lady on the other side of the phone was a bit uncomfortable talking about money, and normally I would be, but I was just like, this is how much I charge, this is what it is.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, I'd really struggled with that, but now I've got a family to build and to look after. That's not a problem anymore.
No.
Have you found that as well?
Yeah, no, I think, obviously, you've been a professional athlete. I was a professional athlete in rugby. Your driver then is the identity of who you can become, where I think when you finish sport, you have this weird civilian... but athletic endeavour of the what if, what should I do, where should I go, who am I, what should I be doing, how much money do I want to earn, etc. The minute you get the text message, the call, what my wife did was just throw the phone at me saying that she would show me a picture of the pregnancy 6 inches, she was preggers after I had the worst day at work I had in months. You suddenly realise actually what your time is worth. And I think, especially for me personally, I work mainly online, and I go and similarly, you go speak to schools and you do this, and your time could be lots of different things, and your energy gets the energy vampire is usually, if you imagine energy is like a sponge with which has got water in it, and as you do different tasks, you leave bits of water on everything because you're putting energy everywhere.
Yeah.
When you've got a kid, that goes away of what's actually important, what's pushing your business forward, what connection are you having with your spouse or with your family. I've been so ruthless with my time, and I've actually been the most calmest I've been in business. We've been online for 2 years and it's been extremely volatile, loads of growth. We smashed our first year and our second year. But it's been so, like, now I've never been so calm.
Okay.
Because I'm there going,
yeah,
I just need to do my job, and then I need to look after Rach and the kid.
Yeah.
Rather than before, it was like, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to go and try and please this person, I need to go and have this, all that kind of stuff just fades away, and it's just like, right, what's the actual, the slotted tasks that are actually going to push this boat faster, not what ifs, because what ifs don't matter anymore.
It's exactly what I thought of as you were explaining. I was smiling, and you just said it. It comes back to that sport analogy of, does it make the boat go faster? And if it doesn't, like, leave it to one side.
Yeah, and I think the issue we have in our space, I think, like you said, we've got a connection already from being a previous athlete, and also with the opportunity, business is quite open. We're not just, cool, I work in a shop, or you're trying to do something that's creative and something that's actually, not that it's not been done before, but not been done before by you. Similarly, in my space, you've got two types of coaches. You've got coaches that are willing to sell their soul and their body for money, influencers who are willing to push, excuse my French, shit out, which I feel is unfair to customers, or there's, what do you stand for and what do you fight for? Listening to your podcast on the way in from Manchester, you can already tell the burning desire to give your lessons of what professional sport was, which were actually, if you broke them down, there's probably 50-50 of amazing elation and success, but also the darker parts of being within it. I think you'll have the same thing with parenthood. You have the same thing within your vocation. But the difference is being able to articulate that and be self-aware. That the biggest thing that I've learned over the last, since I left rugby, was self-awareness. I don't really believe in confidence is a byproduct of courage. Like you go and do something, get feedback, you get more confident in it. It's like if your first podcast would have been all over the shop and compared to now where it just is what I do.
Yeah.
Same thing with gymnastics, I assume. As I said, I'm watching the video of you, mate. You're doing 3 million flips and swinging about, chilling as if you could sit there and have a barbecue at the top where me.
But you don't start that way.
No.
You need the evidence to
then get feedback.
Give you that feedback. Then that confidence comes from that evidence.
Yeah. And I think that's what's literally happened with our business is, because I've always been pushing. It's like sailing a ship. You can't see the destination. You're just, I have to be ready because what if something goes wrong? It's your mind playing tricks on you. There's a really good framework called positive intelligence, which talks around, it's like the chimp paradox, where it talks around saboteurs, which is basically your primitive side of your brain is trying to find the negative in something because it's trying to prepare just in case something goes wrong.
Yeah.
It's always usually a formulation of fear and stuff you don't actually know. Whereas I think, like you said, now to be more venom and to be like, I'm actually going to be a dad. You haven't got time to be worrying about something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Get on with it. And it's done. It's made me so much more just calm and nowhere near as I am stressed, but stressed on my terms, if you catch what I mean.
Yeah, you choose where to put your energy.
And I think I'll openly admit I'm very entrepreneurial, but you're similarly not because I want to be. I'll drive a Ferrari. My impact as a rugby player was, we can go a bit deeper if we want, of like my identity around rugby was to prove that I could do it. But I was proving it to other people. And then I got to the end and I realised that it didn't fulfil me. Mm. I was like, I look like my face has been wherever his feet are. I've got a face like a jigsaw puzzle and I haven't got anything to show for it. I did well, but not as well as I wanted to. But then the bigger purpose of what I do as a coach is now give people to the keys to the car, to the vehicle that they want to drive, whether it's with their physical performance, mental performance, and take themselves to the next level, because I resonate with the stereotype underdog, high achiever, driven individual, because they've got a chip on their shoulder. They want to. I was reading your story, how you compete. You broke your hand in one of your and you kept going. Like that, it's like the ultimate like underdog. Like, come at me, and it gives me goosebumps thinking about it because it's such a like a. It's an energy thing.
Do you know what's really funny about that story? After I did it, because that was I just turned 15. When I was 15, I looked like I was 7, and. I broke my wrist doing that skill, carried on the rest of the routine, and I did like the rest of the routine on one hand and just my fingertips. When I finished, the coaches went, "Don't cry." They came up to me and said, "Don't cry. Don't let anyone see that you're crying." I was like, "This is odd. Why are they doing this?"
Yeah.
And we won the gold medal. It was the first time GB has ever won a gold medal in a team event, and it was in a junior event, but the first time.
Still.
And I realised afterwards it was because of that, that move got banned from gymnastics.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't want everyone to see that we've pushed this young kid to do this very dangerous skill. And then after that, it got banned because of me, because I'd done that. It looked crazy that this really young kid was trying to do this dangerous skill and broke his wrist, so it got banned after that and got taken
out
of like junior gymnastics. But it's funny that you brought that up because I'm writing a book at the minute. I've just wrote about that in a chapter.
But it's also it's a tough line, because in society right now there's a huge fear around taking risk. If you take risk, you step away from it. Whereas I think if you're looking to do something special, whether it's youngster trying to become a professional athlete, There's no risk without you have to have risk to get the reward. And I had that with my rugby career, was similar. I played with all sorts, played a whole game with a broken jaw. I had my leg snapped in half by a horse, came back to play 10 months later. I've had all that, and my story's been built around adversity. Not because I was the most athletic, not because I was the most gifted, not because I was like, I don't know, insert some crazy rugby. I was the most stubborn little shit who was willing to fight for everything. And I feel that we lose that. Don't get me wrong, they shouldn't be pushing kids into a position where they're going to snap themselves in half. But for you as an athlete, it's that's the difference. That's the 1%. Is there's not many people that can put themselves in that arena of, I'm still going to keep going forward. Yeah. I'm still going to keep producing the goods. I'm still going to be, like you said, you adapt and overcame, and you responded to a negative situation with a positive, which had a huge impact on the outcome, which will, by default, we'll change your life. But if you said that in the moment, if someone said, "Oh yeah, mate, you've snapped your wrist," now you'd be like, yeah, man, I'm out. Where then it was do or die. And I think that's, it's such a fun, like an odd topic for people to sort, because people shy away from risky situations.
Yeah, it's one thing that I actually do. I purposely try to take risks now because I'm very aware that the older I get, the more risk averse I'm going to become, especially when I become a dad. So I'm trying to put myself, and Sam has mentioned to me that you do, and you told me that you do jiu-jitsu. I started doing jiu-jitsu 3 weeks ago, which is so far out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate confrontation. I've never thrown a punch, so I hate it. And I turned up into that environment not knowing, but I'm doing it on purpose to myself outside of my comfort zone. Will, let's go back to when you began getting into sport. Where did your relationship with sport begin? And in particular, rugby, when did you get into rugby?
I started sport, I was actually a tennis player.
Okay.
I played tennis since I was four. My dad was a tennis player. He was a bandy, bow-legged, skinny dude who played football. He wasn't a rugby player at all, hated rugby. And I was a big kid. I basically screwed my Achilles. I couldn't run, got fat, realised I was fat, rubbish at football, really good. I was good at tennis, but hand-eye coordination was really good. Started playing rugby when I was seven. Long story short, I was playing county tennis, county cricket, county rugby. I threw javelin for London when I was 15. Went to road to Wimbledon, and my first match, I got absolutely smashed. Like, by this little Chinese kid, he was tiny. He looked 11, and I walked in there thinking, I'm going to destroy this dude. And he just hammered me. Didn't even play good. He just tapped the ball back in. And I didn't have the head. I couldn't stay cool. I was very emotional.
Right, okay.
That's probably where the violence came in from rugby. I was the opposite. It was weird. Tennis, I was like aggressive, but in rugby, I could let it out. It was like, let go of the monster and let it have it. I was a wasp. And then I just went home. I was like, Dad, I can't play. I'm never going to play. I always wanted to play professional sport. I was like, that was my totem for life, was I wanted to be a professional athlete. I didn't know what. It was like, tennis or rugby, or okay. I had this weird thing about, javelin, but professional javelin throw is a bit of a, you got to be huge or a fat dude really now. So I went home. I was like, Dad, it doesn't give me energy anymore. Like, the same way, I'm going to be one of those dudes, like 900th in the world, that lives in a camper van next to the tennis court and not make any money. So that's where the rugby sort of took off from, right, this is what I'm going to do.
And have you always been built like a rugby player? The reason I ask that is because there's a concept that we've spoke about on this podcast before. I've done it in solo episodes and asked athletes, in that I kind of feel like now I ask the question, are you attracted to a sport because you fit the physical mold, or does the sport build that? And you've kind of answered that for me already, in that you said, mentally, in my mindset, I quite liked the violence and I felt free playing rugby, but also I was a bigger kid and I struggled at maybe football and that kind of thing, so it led me into rugby. And I think with gymnastics, obviously, if you're 6'5", you're not going to do it.
It is nature versus nurture, right? There is a bit of the, we use it, I talk a lot when I was working, and you've got sort of genetics of the person in front of you. So like you said, a gymnast, if you close your eyes and say gymnast at 7 or 8 years old, they're tiny, weeny, shredded, they're swinging about on rings in their bedroom, and they're good, they're quick, but athletic, like basketball, useless. Yeah. Whereas then you say the environment dictates, because then on the flip of it, gymnastics has got this huge context of, when you do start gymnastics properly, it's the 6 hours a day training, the stretching, the... You're spinning around, and there's evidence in relation to whether it's a stunt your growth or whether it does, I don't know. Me, it was weird. I was a beast when I was in year seven, playing rugby, and I was playing tennis, and a girl called Freya called me fat in a swimming pool. Shout out to Freya. I was about to say, I was rinsing her, I'm not. But I literally went from being a fat kid to, I dropped six pack. I was like, dropped weight within... I wasn't doing anything stupid, not eating disorder, but I went full... regimented. I'm training twice a day. I train every day. I watch what I ate.
And the catalyst for that was what that girl
had said. She just embarrassed me in the swimming pool. Man. And those girls that I fancied. Genuine. I'd got injured. I was the kind of kid that, I'm not into sweets, I'm not into desserts. I was the kind of kid that I'd eat two roast dinners. I just loved my food. It was nothing to do with, like, I wasn't chowing whatever chocolate in the back of the sofa. I'd eat your plate and mine. And that's where the sort of the want and need to be better came from, because I suddenly saw that what I could do with training could massively manipulate my body.
Okay.
But I had the same thing in rugby. I was never tall enough, never strong enough, never fast enough, never fit enough. it was always, you're never good enough. So my training and my education all was to fortify. If I said that I was too small, I put muscle on. Said that wasn't strong enough, I get stronger. Said I wasn't fast enough, I'll go do speed work. It was my way of saying, fuck you, excuse my French, I am going to do it. And I overcame it. This is why I played professionally. I didn't play for the British Lions. I wasn't like a 6'4" freak who's. I was just literally this little stubborn. I was willing to die for it. And I think that's probably where it was more of a mental thing than a physical attribute.
And that, you had that chip on your shoulder.
Full chip on my
shoulder. Because I did have that when I was younger. And people would say things, and I'd be the classic, well, I'm going to prove you wrong.
Watch.
Then I got to an age where I started to notice that and then think, no, I'm not giving you the satisfaction. I know what you're trying to do here. Like, I'm like 4D chessing you, and I don't need to be pushed by that.
Sure.
And I actually, I'm kind of sad that I lost that. I think it took my edge away quite a bit.
It does.
Towards the end of my career, I kind of like started to associate certain attributes of being successful in an individual sport as being quite negative. Being quite selfish, like I isolate. I didn't want to be like that.
I
wanted friends. I wanted people around me. It was like I was stuck between two minds a little bit. Just tell me a bit, Will, about what are the big differences between when you're 16, 17, you're playing rugby. What are the big differences between me going into a football changing room and then a rugby changing room in terms of like the cultural differences? Because I think we do see the sports as very different, right? Rugby is a lot about, I just think in general, people have a lot more respect for what you put on the line physically when you're playing rugby. And the sport itself seems like it's a bit more about respect. And I'm sure a lot of that is to do with the fouls and people diving and all of that kind of stuff. But what are some of the, what would you see in those dressing rooms from an early age?
From an early age?
Yeah, that would be different to football.
The biggest, if you took both sports with no parents and you said to that both types of sport, whatever you play right now will not affect your future, they'll be the same.
Okay.
Because the thing about football is there's a huge connotation of if my son or daughter is 7 years old and they're scoring goals, they're going to get picked up by Arsenal, they're picked up by Arsenal, they're going to make 100 grand a year at 12 years old. There's this connotation. Rugby doesn't have that. Rugby has, at 14, you may get picked up for a scheme where you'll get one gym session a week and go and do some extra passing drills. And then by 16, the progression is a lot further away. So I think culturally, football is a very, very selfish individual sport now compared to, if you listen to the likes of Manchester United, exact opposite. But that's because it's all about the team. Whereas I find that the young people now are looking at football as an escape route of, it's all about me, I'm going to be the best. And it doesn't matter what happens. Rugby, it has that, but it gets knocked out of you pretty quick because if you're that cocky little shit that's going to take it, someone's going to literally steamroll you and stamp on your face. And it sounds quite gladiatorial, but that's literally what happens in comparison to football. I feel the football thing is driven a lot by perception of the later stages of their development, which is brilliant. But I don't think it's channeled in the right way. I think people they focus on little Tommy's going to be the next Manchester Man City striker, and that's all, rather than him being a better athlete or him being. If you watch David Beckham, like, even though he was a freak, he practiced free kick and hit a golf post for 10 hours. Johnny Wilkinson was the same. That's why if you watch them both as athletes or as people, they're very self-aware. They're very driven. But it's all about the game. It's all about being better at their whatever skill it is. I find that, like, youth sport, this is where it comes down to, you mentioned about jiu-jitsu. The transversible skill from a gymnast into jiu-jitsu is wild. Like, you'll murder people, man, just because of your athleticism around your body, your balance, your skill, your coordination, your hand to eye from catching bars and stuff. If you put a rugby player in that situation, it's the one thing that's called me down. Because by my second session, I got put to sleep. Because I thought this 57 kilo little Chinese kid again, Singaporean, he got me in a collar choke and I thought, fuck you little bastard, drop my shoulder, sleep, gone, for long on the floor. The point was, I'm not thinking about it compared to, it was just a skill that beat me. Jiu-jitsu taught me that. But you, on the other hand, your athleticism and your caution around like the uncertainty actually will get you out of so much more. Because you couldn't put a rugby player on rings and see him do what you do. But I could put you on a rugby pitch on the wing and see you do it. You see what I mean?
The skill of it is
massive. So I think, come back to your point, so I've circumducted. It's difficult, but I do think that we're not letting kids the best thing about me, but from my background, was I played everything. My dad was a football player through and through. Like, not, he hated rugby until I played rugby. I was never forced. I think that's what happens in football, is little Tommy's going to play for Liverpool and that's it.
Yeah.
Issue.
And
I think
parents have that influence,
and they have expectation. They don't let their kids explore.
Yeah,
they don't let their kids just be.
Do you think the value system's slightly off as well? So
massive.
It's a different value system. Like in rugby, you look at, it's about, oh, look how brave that guy is. Mm. Whereas in football, it's like, look how much money he makes.
Yeah, it literally is. Yeah.
There's a real difference.
Massive difference. And I think that it comes down to age. Like you said, the parents have got pound signs in it, but there's also like a, I think you correct me, in gymnastics, it's a young person's sport. So you haven't got long.
Yeah.
So they go, we need to make this happen now. Mm. Where rugby, I know rugby players that have been picked up. They can't remember his name. The scrum half for England got picked up when he was 30, like from Northampton to play for England. You'd never see a gymnast go to the Olympics, I wouldn't assume.
Yeah, I mean,
within reason.
It's very rare.
Yeah.
The careers are growing a bit, just as the sports science comes into it more.
Yeah, sure.
But again, there's always going to be a limit because the money's not there.
No,
do you know
it's
what
different.
I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's a bit like, with rugby, maybe you would see that more in the kids if the money was there. Do you know what I mean? I think most kids that start playing football start because they love it, but somewhere along the way, the money and the fame becomes a factor because it really is. It's just part of the journey. If you're going to be successful, you're going to have money and everything thrown at you.
Yeah.
And then it's really difficult maybe then to, how do you control that if you're a parent and you're not in control. The coaches are in control. Like, the system. Do you know what I mean?
No. Very, very much so. Like,
but I just feel personally,
it'll change your life.
Yeah. I'd never been in a rugby changing room, but I'd imagine there would be some differences.
Oh, it's very, how'd you say? I was a very wise rugby player in relation to, because I was in the middle of the war zone, the middle of the firefight all the time. Like I'll tackle everything. And if there was a fight, I was in the middle of it. If one of my teammates was in the middle of something, we're going all in. I was such a team player.
Okay.
I then gave me a lot of authority to, if a new kid came in who was being that proverbial footballer who is way more ego-driven, you'd knock him down to size quick.
Yeah, but you would do that.
It's a culture thing.
And maybe the issue is that doesn't exist in the game of football anymore because players are protected by the ref and you can't go in and smash someone. Because players are worth so much money, at the big clubs, you're not going to tackle much. So that element of not being knocked down to size, but taking the knocks has been taken away from that sport.
Yeah,
does that
sure.
Make sense?
And I think, but also in team, like if you looked at the time when I was watching football, like people like Roy Keane, but in the Neville boys at Manchester United, it was all about Man U. If you put it into rugby, the All Blacks, you leave the shirt as you left it. It's the cultural difference and the understanding of being a better All Black.
This is bigger than you.
They're literally that. And we used to have that. I was at Cinderford, which is an old mining town. And I went there, basically, when I was 18, captain when I was 19. And again, we scalped everyone because it's the most, you go up there, it's bleak up there, and the people up there are horrible, lovely people on the pitch, horrible, not good rugby players, violent.
Yeah.
But it was all bait. If you had an ego, if you came, your London team came up there, mate, you were coming back with all broken noses. It just wasn't happening. Whereas in football, you've got a Sunday league where they think that the people are just aimless and stupid, but if you've got the people that are playing sort of the lower leagues, the culture around the team is, like you said, I'm here for me because I could get transferred somewhere else. And then I got, whereas in rugby, it doesn't.
Yeah.
There's so many players, I've got friends of mine who are like, they've got 300 caps for Hull. It's Hull, but he's from Hull and he dives and bleeds it. You see what I mean? I think there is that piece of, you give somebody power, sometimes they just don't know what to do with it. And in football, I think more so when they're young, the parents have a lot of power. The value system is very, very different. Because in rugby, mate, it just doesn't.
What's the pathway? If you're a young rugby player and you've got aspirations of playing at a high level, what does the pathway look like? As you mentioned there, you can get brought up at like, say, 14 and go and do a bit of extra training once a week. What did that pathway look like for you?
For me? So I was at Wasps when I was a kid. I played Wasps since I was 7. I played there till I was 15 at Colts. I was always the rugby player that was like close. So I was always like, you're nearly on the academy. You're nearly at this thing. But I went to Hartbury and started in the 13. In my first year, I made captain of the under-18s, where I got picked up by Gloucester. So I went to Gloucester Academy. So Gloucester Academy started then. was like, it's a lot early now because they've got a thing called the ACE scheme. So this is why you can pick when you're 14. When I was there, there was no such thing. So it was 16 plus. But now I think it's 14 plus. There was a few youth things that you could do, but more actual, you're with Gloucester, we're going to give you Gloucester kit and you can play for Gloucester at that age. I went to the eight, so I played A-League, which is the one below the Premiership team, where I was there for 3 years. But I was at Hartbury. So again, I was just fighting for my shirt, to be honest, mate. Like, I went from Hartbury College, where I was the captain of the first team, and I thought I was Bertie Big Balls, so I was straight back into uni. And men's rugby's different. College rugby is because we had such a good team culture. My coach was insane. Like, Alan Lewis was. We had Chris Juicenap as well. Then Linney, and I went to Alan Lewis. They had a huge coaching. Hartbury was the biggest growing rugby college in the country by a long way. Like, we went from the bottom leagues all the way up to now they're in the Championship, being promoted every year. Like, they were one of those. I actually handed my scholarship back at Hartbury at one point because I was getting no game time. So that's why I went to National One, right. Which is still paid. It's semi-pro. There's no money. It's not like you're getting paid. The football was semi-pro or like the third league from Premiership of football. You can still buy a house every month, whereas this was not that. I basically did National One back to Hartbury for my master's degree. And then that's when I got picked up to play. In between that, I went to Exeter Chiefs for pre-season, which I basically got the grades for uni, but I did a BTEC, not A-levels.
Right.
And my home comforts were in Gloucester, man. I knew everybody in Gloucester. I was with Gloucester Academy, which I thought was good, which wasn't really. I should have stayed at Exeter. Everything was calling me back. Exeter was amazing. And that's the one move that I would change. I'd have stayed there. Would I have played any higher? I don't know.
At this point when this is going on, is rugby your sole focus?
Everything. I'm from a... My parents were very much a case of you do need to have an education. And I was not stupid enough to think... It's weird. It's a very double-edged sword because I've kind of changed my mind about this a few times.
Right, okay.
About, like, I've got really good education. I've got a BSc degree in strength conditioning and coaching. I've got a master's degree, which I got for free for rugby, which was at Hartbury. But that, when I went to do my master's, was when I was going to Exeter. So I made a choice. I made a choice of compromise of I'm going to get education and I could go and play the next level, or I could stay in, because Exeter were in the Championship in that year, they got promoted. I've always been, I had to be a pro rugby player. Like, since when I left tennis, I didn't care about anything else. Like, my education, I'm one of those, I'm a clown, man. I enjoyed education. I wasn't the most brightest kid.
You had a very well-defined goal.
It wasn't
open-ended, like, I'm just going to play and see where it takes me. Like, I want to play at the highest level.
I wanted to play pro. Now, if I could go back, I would have tightened that gap.
Okay.
I would have said, I want to play 100 games for Gloucester and play for England.
Okay.
So I wanted to play for England. I was always on the cards for, like, England schools, England colleges, England, the England counties is where national rugby, you've got England A team, so England first team, you've then got their A team, and then England counties is the national one team, so they're not pro, but they're like, they're representative of the country. I've always wanted to play for them. Unfortunately, never got there. Yeah. I played 10 years in national one. I was like the old, everyone, I was like the old head in national, everyone knew me in national one. Just for this is the Cinderford thing. And I went to Donny, and that was when I first signed pro, like that, and that was like my dream. Even though, like, looking back, it was Donny. They came down from the Championship, lost all their money, needed to regroup, and they're picking everyone out of the national team, national one team, to go back into the Championship. That was but at that point I had a farm, I was working four jobs, I had no money, like, right. I wasn't leaving it to chance, but that was my break.
And did you start getting paid at that point? You signed for
I was making 18 grand a year, mate. So this is where PT came in. Right. Was everyone thinks professional sport's glamorous, man. Unless you are
the top
of your game,
don't
pretend that you're going to be making bank, because you're not. And even boys in the national, in the Championship, where they were making double that, they were like the Messies of that league. And it's not even 32 grand when you've got two kids and you're living the life, like, you're not there half the time.
Yeah.
Is it worth it? I don't know. I didn't care about the money.
I wanted to play pro.
It was like my identity was, I am playing pro.
Yeah.
And then that's when I had my accident 8 weeks later.
Yeah.
where my ex-missus was getting, she was lunging a horse on her own, a youngster, and it turned and started trampling on her.
What's lunging a horse mean?
So you see in cowboy films when they've got a horse on a rope,
yeah,
and they're going around in a circle,
yeah,
that's lunging. Okay. And when you want a horse to move properly, you put a thing called a piece of rope behind its bum, which makes it tuck its butt, basically makes it move nicely. It's called a pursuer. I probably butchered that for the equestrian people out there, so forgive me, but to my knowledge, that's what it is. Layman's terms, this horse just turned on her and started trampling her. And I got involved. I heard her screaming and ran in. As I said, I was 8 weeks into my first pro rugby contract. I was living away from home, so she was in Hereford, near Hereford, and I was playing in Doncaster, so I was coming back on the weekends.
Okay.
Long story short, I had it by the head, and it was just like, the world had stopped and I knew it was going to kick me, so I let go of its head, turned, and it kicked me in the side of the knee and snapped my leg in off.
Wow.
I was just screaming. I thought I'd lost my rugby career. I was literally like, that's it. What? I remember ringing my mum, screaming down the phone that I've lost everything, and she's laughing at me. She thought I was joking. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, mum, I need you to come get me now, screaming. I was trying to go upstairs and get a gun and all this other, like, we had a shotgun in the house, like, we were on a farm. Like, I was like, I didn't know to shoot the horse, but I wasn't going to do that. It was just emotion. I just remember being sat in the hospital and someone picked up my foot and it turned, they picked up my leg and just kept going. It was literally 90 degrees. Yeah, that was really bad. But I came back from it. So I lost absolutely everything, though, from that.
What, I mean, that's an incredible story, mate. And, you know, when I retired, I started playing seven-a-side football. Mm. And at the start of the season, I tried to play 11-a-side. And I was absolutely gobsmacked with the difference in the speed, the aggression, the physicality, just from going seven-a-side to playing 11s on a Saturday. And just the contact, the risk, so high risk.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, of getting injured. And I'm like,
is it worth
this
it?
This is affecting work. I can't do this. It's too high risk. When you're playing a sport like rugby, times that by 10, had you had a lot of injuries in your career prior to getting kicked by the horse?
I had all superficial. So I've had like 300 stitches across my face, my ear ripped off twice. That was once was from my own shirt, not from cauliflower ears. Stuff. Collarbone, broken fingers, nothing major.
Really? So that was the first time?
It was the first thing that ever stopped me from playing for more than 4 weeks was getting kicked by a horse, yeah. Which was weird because my position was, my position was to tackle, that was it.
Right.
So if you put it on paper, that's the most risky thing. I was never.
What was the injury, mate?
I had a fully dislocated knee. So I ruptured my ACL, PCL and MCL.
Did you have to, was the surgery involved with that?
I had four surgeries. I had ligaments done at the same time. I had two of them were dead people, so I got allograft ligaments from. I asked for like an ex-professional NFL player, but it's definitely some fat dude from America or something that passed away. So yeah, I had that, and I had my own hamstring.
It's called a skin graft.
Yeah, I know. So what they usually do with an ACL is they take a graft from your tendon and they put it in your knee.
Okay.
I had someone else's, and they got my hamstring and just literally stapled it to the side to try and rebuild because your MCL will regrow.
Okay.
I then had complications because I was on crutches so long. I had scar tissue, so I had to have it physically manipulated because it wouldn't bend. Excuse me. I had, by mistake, they left one of the staples in. So my leg was just, it was green. And it wouldn't start. I had to go and I walked into this and I was like, mate, this is not normal. And he just got a scalpel because I can't feel it. I've got no nerve. He just cut it open and just pulled it straight. Honestly,
really?
Mate. Yeah.
Wow.
I had it manipulated. I had it manipulated once. Ligaments in once, suture once, and I had to sort out one of the screws the other time. But yeah, I came back in 10 months.
10 months, and what did they say? Look, Will, this could be your career over.
No, they said it was
my career
over.
It's likely to be this amount of time.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your response to that? Because it sounds like you're, again, coming back to the, if someone tells me no, I'm going to push it.
Mm.
And what's your knee like now?
I remember going into the operation, Derek Bickerstaff, shout out to him, he's not even a surgeon anymore, but I literally said to him, I said, give me a chance. He said, well, I can't give you a chance, insurance reasons. He said, but off the book, you'll be lucky to walk and run and be normal. You can't be a carpet fitter, but I can't tell you can play rugby again. And I was like, you need to give me 1%. He's like, no, I can't. At that point, it's weird, mate. Like, there's things in your life that you'll realise were bigger lessons, and this was the biggest lesson ever. Like, I was in a relationship that we didn't love each other anymore. It was venomous, man. We were there. I was with her since I was 18, and we just totally grown apart. I just didn't have the bottle to leave her, for us to leave. I had no money. I was working jobs that I hated. There wasn't an option. I lost my house. We parted ways. I moved up to Doncaster with just my dog, left all my kit at home. We broke up really badly just because, again, it was just emotions ran high. And everyone was like, mate, no chance. Apart from my physio. Shout out to Tash Bedford. She promised me I could do it. I said, I just need someone to believe in me. Simon Sinek did a really good talk on our TED Talk saying that all you need is one person to say you could do it. There was an option. I was willing to have my leg cut off, which is quite aggressive, but for my whole life, since I was 15, I was going to play pro. I'm going to make it to England. I'm going to go and play for Gloucester first team. I'm going to be in the Guinness Premiership, watch. And then someone just takes it away. Yeah. And it was very much a moment of like, I just remember, as I said, I was sat in hospital wearing clothes that didn't match and wellies with a leg snapped in half, thinking, well, what are you doing? And it was the biggest life lesson of... I was responsible for where I was in. It was all, I blame myself. Which everyone was like, yo, she shouldn't be doing that, but she shouldn't have. But I think if you blame somebody else, you give somebody else the power over you. Where it wasn't. It was a life lesson. This is where you talk about being a man. As a man, I should have taken responsibility and not been in that situation. And I should have had that conversation way before it got to that. That was just life telling me, mate, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And rehab-wise was just, yeah, I was told I should be back fully fit 18 months and I did it in 10. It was from necessity. It was from, I remember they strapped me to a bed. Neymar had a picture of him doing it. They used to strap you to a bed and manipulate your knee. You're not supposed to do that anymore for an ACL. But I had to get 135 degrees of flexion to run and I was at 124. Strapped me to a bed. And they literally had two physios strap me to a bed and they're pushing my leg and I'm screaming, I'm biting on something. And the guy that owns the club walks in and he just walks in and he's like, who the FNL is making all this noise? I've never sworn at someone like my life. Oh, you effing fab. I'm rinsing this dude, screaming at him. And he's got a full hairdryer back on the table, bending my knee. Looking back, it's quite barbaric. Yeah. But it was purely, I'd seen the bottom of where, as I said, I literally... me and my dog Tia, that was it.
Do you think, Will, like, you've talked about having a bit of a chip on your shoulder and that girl back when she told you that you were fat when you were swimming and people telling you can't do it, do you think everybody maybe has a limit, though, and you reached your limit and in that moment what you needed wasn't somebody to go, you can't do it, like the surgeon, potentially, not that he said that directly to you, but then that one physio that said you can do it, mm-hmm. Do you think in that moment that's what you needed? Actually, I've spent my whole life needing people to tell me that I can't do it to prove them wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so low right now, I need someone to tell me you can do it.
Yeah, yeah, massive. I think the biggest lesson to date has been I used to try and prove everybody wrong. Now I'm here to prove myself right.
Okay.
And I think that's, I learned that from that moment of... There's a big thing. I had a friend of mine. I just did an Ironman where it all went wrong. Like my lung collapsed halfway through the marathon, and I finished it. I was the most stubborn mule ever. Got to the end. I was in hospital for 5 days, and I was quite embarrassed because it was all going so right and doing so well. My friend who he's climbed Everest without oxygen. He's one of those kind of. He's a marathon runner. Looks like a candle. Runs it in like 2 hours flat, and I'm not sure if he's a vegetarian, but I judge him if he is. He just texts me like saying, the reason why you're doing this is because you're trying to prove and have trust with yourself. And it was very much true. The same with my rugby career is I always look back and I do have a lot of regret because I'm in a team sport. It's a bit different. I think my wife's obviously a swimmer, so like an individual sport, you leave it out on the table, you either win or you lose. You're either the fastest in the pool or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Rugby's quite opinionated. Yeah. So you could have... I had a game where I was man of the match and I was dropped the next week. Yeah. Emotionally, mate. Head was gone. Stuff like that was very much a case of, yeah, building trust with me and needing... I can't tell you the power of having a team behind you that believes in you.
Yeah. How quickly did you make the shift, mate, when you had that injury... and the horse kicked you and you're sat in the hospital, you're being told you might not even walk properly again or run. How quickly did you make that shift in going from I'm the victim to no, I need to take responsibility? Was that like straight away, or did that take a long period of time?
It didn't take too long because I was so, it made me so hyper-focused. Nothing mattered. I literally was
to willing. You, was that the worst thing that could have happened to you at that point?
Yeah, like, that was the worst thing.
So you hit your rock bottom.
I literally was like, I fought my whole life to get here and someone's going to take it away from me. Never. But I think it comes, that's an age thing too. I was at an age, I had no responsibilities. I had someone who, again, me and her, it was done. Apart from that, I had financial obligations. This was about what, then when you're young, you think about legacy all the time. You're like, oh, I'm going to be this Guinness World rugby player, this. Now, like being a dad, very opposite. My job is to be really good at business to make enough money so my family can have what they want and do what they want, but actually be the vessel for my kid to then have what I had at my house, which again, I think that comes with age. But at that point, there was literally nothing else. Like what I'd gone through to get to that pro contract, which wasn't even that, it wasn't like I'd signed for Saracens on 100 grand a year. I'd signed for Donny. Like, I was literally like, nothing else. And that's when it came down to like being all in. I was all in with that.
Yeah.
It's very, but to your point earlier about drive and determination, there's only so long you can use that as a fuel.
Yeah.
Otherwise, like you said, the minute you have other obligations, like now I'm nowhere near like wired like that.
Yeah.
I am in a different sense, but not like, I'm not willing to lose my missus and my kids for anything for that reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, at that point, it just, I don't know, it's weird.
How is your knee now, mate? How is it now?
So I've thought, fine. I can do absolutely everything fine with it, yeah. I can't feel it. They drill for my nerves. So I've got kickboxing. I'll beat anybody. No problem. Jiu-jitsu, I was told I'll never do jiu-jitsu. I've done jiu-jitsu for 7 years.
So do you have full range in that knee?
I've got 135. You should have 145. So you should have 10.
So, close,
so I can do this. I can pull my leg to my bum, but I can't pull my heel to my bum.
Right, okay.
I can pull it, but I can't. Technically do it for my brain.
Yeah, I only have a certain, I had surgery on that ankle because I completely obliterated that left ankle. So I have carbon fiber ligaments on that side. So, and I only have a certain, it just can only go that
only
far.
Only go so far,
My biggest issue again was scar tissue.
Sure, yeah.
So I'd pull scar tissue every few months on the way back because it'd go a little bit further past where it could. And the scar tissue would kill for like 6 weeks.
Yeah,
but then
I'd
get a bit more range.
Sure.
And that happened like 6 or 7 times. So I'm limited a little bit with range, but I genuinely thought it would, I was worried about later in life, am I going to be able to run or play football? It's actually fine. It's like, all right. Jiu-jitsu is not a problem.
Nah, really, it's like one of those, I'm obviously in the sort of the health and fitness space. The context of what's finite, so what doctors will say and what the sort of NHS will say, there's always room for error and there's always outliers.
And it's probably, I would imagine, it's a bit like, you know, when you go on your phone and you use like Apple Maps and you like see how far it is to walk somewhere and it's like a mile and it says like 30 minutes. Like, it ain't taking me 30 minutes to walk a mile.
House,
but that's just for the average person.
Yeah.
That's the same with what the doctors and the hospitals and the surgeons, they're going to give, this is the average, but you're probably
research,
a bit of an outlier because you're an athlete and you've got to the level that you've got
to. Yeah, and also there's like a,
and it's different, I imagine it's different from person to person, right? If you took 10 people and did the same surgery, everyone would react
slightly
differently.
So three people had it in the same 6 months as me,
right,
only
okay.
I came back.
Right,
okay. They kept getting swelling, they just never were the same. But because I literally gave myself not an option.
Mm.
And does it move the same? My left hand side of my body moves totally different to my right.
Yeah.
My leg or my damaged leg is hamstring dominant. My other leg is quad dominant. My glute is 30% smaller than the others. It's all that kind of stuff. I just don't think about it because I haven't really got an option.
And you did it, mate. You successfully came back, which in itself, as a lesson for the rest of your life, you can always say, hey, look, that happened and I still made it back, which is a massive thing. That's a big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that, okay, is the be-all and end-all and you shouldn't put your body on the line like that, but no, that's the evidence, again, to say, look, if something really tough comes up in life, because you will have found now, and I find this, I'd take the issues I had in sport over the real life issues every day of the week.
Every day of the
because
week.
Because when it comes to family stuff and that's hard.
Mm.
But me decide, if me having a bad competition or me, I'll take that, give that to me.
Yeah,
I want
yeah.
that stress compared yeah. to like real life stress. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, but it's because I think as you get older, you realise that sport is only sport. But when you're in sport, it's not, it's like, it's everything.
Everything to you.
But then
yeah,
when you've been
yeah.
in it, like you said, you'd be walking up to the bars before you retire and going, whatever, I can do this. when GB gave you the first ring up and said, "Oi, do you fancy doing this?" And wearing that, mate, that the feeling of just like being accepted for being that good would have been. Whereas when you've done it for a million times, like whatever. I used to get. It's the reason why I realized I knew when it was time to quit was when I didn't have the fire in my belly.
You lost, lose that.
I didn't have my edge, mate. Nah, I could do it. I could just do it. And it wasn't that I was brilliant. It was just because I knew I couldn't get to the next. I was 27, 28, and I moved to Singapore. The rugby there is very different. It's just, it's not pub rugby. That's the wrong term. It's more social rugby.
Okay. Do you feel like you squeezed all the juice out of your orange in your rugby career?
I reckon I had 5 or 10% more. But I should have done it when I was in that position of getting kicked by a horse. If I could have, I tried my hardest. I haven't left anything on the table with rugby. Yeah. I wish if I could go back, I wish I'd committed more and maybe I've been a bit more ruthless with everything else. Like you said, maybe my education. It's what people ask me, like, because now that set me up, my business and everything has set me up to. I took 30% of my professionalism from sport and I put it into education, and now it's really set me up. But I always say, if a kid comes to me at 14, 15 and says, mate, I want to be a professional rugby player, go absolutely all in. Because if you don't, you'll regret it.
Mm.
But you have a responsibility of when you're not doing rugby, what else are you doing? That's what I say. I've got one, I worked with a client of mine. He actually plays at Donny now. And we were talking to him about, like, when you're not doing rugby, if you're just sat there playing PlayStation, problem. Because you there's more to life than this sport, but getting into it, yeah, man, like you got to commit to doing the reps and doing the time and not being fearful of the what if I can't, because what if you can? But this is the problem with sport as well, is there's like a 1% thing, as if you make it, if you watch the likes of like Dan Carter or MySpace, Richie McCaw and stuff, that they're so level headed, they've got other ventures and they're doing so many cool things. It's because they've gave everything to sport, but they're putting everything into family life or business. A lot of sportsmen, I feel, don't give, they leave something on the table. I don't miss rugby whatsoever, but that's because my meaning of it's changed. I can't even believe I've done rugby, let alone, it's such a weird part of my life for me. After I left, because I went through this massive.
I was going to ask, me, did you find it hard to find your place in the world after rugby? Did you, because you moved quite a bit, it sounds like you moved
The so reason why I moved
Australia, Singapore, were you kind of just trying to figure out how you fit in?
Mate, like, I ran away, bruv.
Is that what it was?
I had no money and I was doing the same old monotonous stereotype ex-rugby player thing of playing a bit of semi-pro on the side and having three different jobs, just living in someone else's gaff. She was lovely, but just, and it was just a hovel, like not literally a hovel, but just not. I was thinking, man, I'm heading towards 30, but I don't even know what I want to do. The only thing that's been a constant in my life is I worked in a gym since I was 14. And then I saw Singapore and I was like, the biggest change I did was I rang my Manly Marlins. I was like, all right, I'm coming over to Australia. When I played over there, changed my life going over there, because I suddenly realised that the world is bigger. And then for Singapore, it was like, I need to make a drastic change because I am brassic and I don't know. Me and Rach were serious, but not like, we've been together for a few years and she was around the world of swimming. So I was like, I need to make a huge change for myself now. The only way to do it is take a risk. And the only risk is go somewhere. I've seen friends of mine succeed. If they can do it, I can do it. I burn the bridges is the term of like, I literally got on the plane with just going, I'm going to make this happen. I don't know how I'm going to make this happen.
No plan B, just.
Mm-mm, no plan B. It was like, I'm all in here. I moved over there, as I said, I'd barely any money to my name, slept in someone else's gaff for a while, and I ended up, after 5 years, I came back, bought a house. I was one of the most sought-after PTs in the CBD, full client list, all those other cool accolades from a professional standpoint, apart from the rugby bit, died off. I got into coaching. I played 7 games, blew my rib out of my chest, and I thought, this is similar to you getting injured, I haven't got an opportunity as a PT. And then I ended up coaching my team, and we won the championship that year. That's probably my biggest, one of the biggest life lessons I've ever had is different being a manager compared to being, and being, because being a coach, you're person driven, but if you've got two people and you're fighting for one position and you know that you've got to break somebody's heart to give somebody else the opportunity, mate, especially if you're me, I'm people pleaser, man, I'm a coach, I want someone to win. And you're like, you know, this dude has just not got it in the locker.
Yeah.
From a professional standpoint, that was really hard.
Do you feel like throughout your career, your rugby career, Will, there were like some... Do you feel like there were like some missing gaps in like your development that you missed out on that is part of the reason why you've now got into coaching other people and then you tried that manager role? Do you feel like, oh, I wish I'd have learnt that, or that was missing, or I made that mistake there and I'm actually motivated to try and help other people not make that mistake?
Yeah, I think your voids will always fill your values, yeah? So whatever you've struggled with, you'll try and... If you've overcame it, you want to coach it, or you want to teach it, or you want to help somebody with it, or you see somebody struggling with it, it doesn't matter how much they get, you do it for free. It's because it's so deep in your core. Mm. I've just been on every side of the coin of feeling not good enough. So then when I've got to a position where I moved to Singapore, no one knew me. So no one knew that story. I didn't need to tell everybody I wasn't good enough. So instead of, there's a really good book from Todd Herman called The Alter Ego Effect, where you take somebody you admire, and you see what traits they have and that you have, but also the traits that you want that you don't have, and you embody them. There's a guy in my industry, Phil Learney, shout out to him. He was the most sought after PT in labor, in Mayfair, UP. I moved to Singapore and I was like, I'm just going to act like him. If I don't know what I'm doing, I'm going to pretend that I'm him and I'm going to do it. And mate, it totally changed me. But just like what you said, yeah, like helping other people has always been in my DNA. The issue is weird. Like, unfortunately, I lost my father last year and the last year before. And I never understood why everyone used to come to him for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it literally suddenly, when I lost my dad, it was everyone comes to me for advice. It's just been part of what my sort of family do. And I understood that the more that I'd been with people, the more people use me as it's called being impressionable. You become the person that somebody needs you to be to get them through what they need to.
Okay.
You take them from pain to the finish and let them go. That's my coaching process. Some coaches want their kids to their people to be with them for like 10 years. I don't. I want to sort your shit out. If you want to stay with me, cool. If you don't, I get it.
Yeah.
I've always had that. We've only just been able to sort of understand that, if you know what I mean.
And was that always in you, even when you were a kid? Do you think always you were growing up, you've always been that?
I remember there was a friend of mine whose mum was abusive, and she was an alcoholic. And she ring me at 11 o'clock at night and nick my dad's brand new bike. Like, this thing is just, you know, the old Raleigh, like, whatevers. And I'm absolutely dusting to this chick's house thinking I'm going to... I was like, I would have been in year 10. Like, what am I going to do to a fully grown adult? Nothing. And I remember pegging it and I broke his wheel. Anyway, so I got to her house. Ended up, it was just an argument. It wasn't as bad as I thought. Got this back and I put the bike back and I went back home. My dad goes to cycle his bike the next day. The wheel is literally bent underneath, brakes gone. I've always been driven... I don't want someone to feel the pain that I've been through. Even though my family life, I was not from this like ghetto or like, you know, my mum's a crack addict and my dad was a drug lord. Absolutely the opposite. Like stereotype, middle class white family, now live in a cottage in fucking Buckingham. It's not like, as I said, the ghetto rags to riches job. I don't know why. I've always had that in me.
Yeah, it's interesting. When my brother moved to Australia just before the pandemic to play football. Mm. Out in Melbourne, and I can remember saying to him, no one knows who you are, you can be whoever you want to be when you go out there.
That's wild,
and
yeah.
My brother's like in terms of technically an incredible player, but would always maybe be slightly not as vocal, like on the pitch and stuff. I can remember saying, no one knows who you are, you can be anyone you want to be.
Yeah.
And he went out there and unfortunately he played one game, had a blinder, and then the pandemic hit and he just got stuck there.
Oh wow.
But I can remember saying that. So it's like you talking about going out to Singapore. No one knows who I am.
It was trying to find myself too. Like, it was literally that.
And was it a combination of, right, I can be anyone I want to be, but I also don't know who I am?
Literally that. I remember getting on a plane with this, like, mask on of, like, I've just got to make this happen, but I've got no idea how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know how it's going to go. I don't know who I'm going to meet. I don't know. I didn't know what I didn't know. It sounds weird. I didn't know what in this day and age is different. What I was like, I was like, I'm not really a rugby player anymore. I'm just doing it for the money and I'm doing it for a bit of just for a laugh on the weekend. I'm no longer wanting to be playing for England and being which I didn't ever get to. I had this like this gap, and that's where I found I had a coach. I had an NLP coach called Jay Headley from the coaching room. I've never been in a conversation where I felt like I've been stripped naked in my life. I mean, he didn't literally, to be clear, but he just totally unpacked why and the reasoning behind the sport and why I was struggling. And in one call, I ended up getting coached by him for 10 calls, and I took the NLP course, and my coaching is very much that. It's, again, voids for your values, isn't it? And I now do that with my clients. It's like, if they're stuck, I'm like, no, that's not that. It's because of this. And that's why I literally stopped rugby. Done. And I didn't, but before that, I was struggling. That's why I started BJJ. I nearly had a scrap with a client because he was being a bellend. And I just couldn't, I hadn't tackled anybody in 6 months. And I was like, I'm going to need to do something violent, otherwise I'm going to get put in prison. But yeah, there was that of, that was my opportunity to not be, I wasn't a failure, but at that point, I got close, and I come back from an injury. No one said I could, and I still play champ, and I still play pro, but I didn't, not the where I wanted to. It comes back to when I started it. I didn't have this, like, I'm going to play 100 games for this club and do this, and it was, I wanted to play pro. So I had got there.
Yeah.
In context, it wasn't what I wanted, but it wasn't because of that. It was because of loads of different factors, but the going to Singapore was the reset button. It was like,
do you know that gap, Will, between retirement, being lost, not knowing what you're doing, trying to figure it out? I think every athlete probably that's competed at a high level has that. Yeah. What's the difference, do you think, in your opinion, having worked with other athletes and people in the world of finance, whatever it is, what stops people going to, right, drink, drugs, alcohol, gambling, that route, as opposed to, I'm lost, I don't know who I am, but I'm going to try and better myself and figure it out. Have you noticed the difference between the two types of people that struggle with that to the point where they just numb everything?
Massively, yeah.
And then other people that maybe go, right, I'm feeling like that, but I'm going to actually try and go out and figure out what's going
on.
Or do you think everyone needs to experience a bit of both? Do you feel you needed that gap of feeling lost
to have a gap of exploration, because you've given so much of your life to something, and your values change as you get older. So if your values aren't in relation to, like, what do you value? Not integrity, resilience, hard work. That's actions. Values are, what do you value? I value self-mastery, so I always want to be educated. Even if I didn't buy education, I'd want to learn new skills, like gymnastics. I can do a muscle up, ugly as anything, and it's literally like a fridge door trying to get up there, but I can do it just pure belligerence of exploration.
Yeah.
Or I value connection. That's why coaching is so big for me. It's because I love people. I like problem solving, but I also like hearing stories around leadership and resilience, because I've gone through that myself. Mm. Most sports men and women who I've dealt with don't funnel what they love about sport into something else.
Okay.
So I know people who are absolutely dominating. There's a guy in Australia, 98 Gym, who's called Chris Feather, ex-rugby league player, had enough of rugby league, went and was a PT, and then his product he designed is a gym. It's basically, it's a strength and conditioning gym, but it's for normal people, but it's more, they want you to be as athletic as possible and to be as strong as possible and be as useful as possible, but the identity of that gym is now his rugby club. So he's taken that rugby club and put it into something. Most people don't know what they actually want and why they're doing the sport itself, or the skills they had in the sport. How can they bring them out in another way, whether it's financially or... So I'll be openly honest, I'm financially driven because I lost all my money.
Okay.
So I moved to Singapore I was brassic and I'd literally lost everything. So I'll tell everybody, I am fine, but not against my values or my standards. Yeah. I'll make money how I want to make money, but I know my values. Similar to you saying before about this teacher ringing you up. You're an ex-Olympic athlete. You're not Joe Bloggs that works on the Leisure Centre, who's just like a 65... No. You're an ex-medalist. I worked with Jazz Carling, so I worked with her in Millfield, same thing. The minute you've... Her value, because she doesn't understand, she's got 20 years of like elite-level experience. Same with you. You'll have one detail that will change someone's whole routine and they'll suddenly go from whatever, this point to this point. Yeah. But you won't believe that, because it's like, what do you mean? You just took your fingers this way.
Yeah.
It's the same with rugby, is like, or anything. Most rugby players or sports people don't know the value that they have, and because they feel like they're being big-headed.
Yeah.
But actually, if they're putting it into the context of impact rather than showing off, the impact of the skills that you have, how much is that worth? That's what I coach. I do a lot around like personal development. Most rugby players, especially rugby, as you get older, it's more chests out, barbaric. I can't be seen to be weak. Mm. I'm hard. That was me. It was all a mask, mate. Mm. I was just trying to prove I was good enough.
How tough is that? How tough is the personal training? And then when you shifted and pivoted and went to the online, how difficult is that world, mate? Because hundreds of people want to do that, don't they? And I see it, like, I go to David Lloyd, my local David Lloyd, and I see new PTs come in and out. It's like a conveyor belt all the time. Yeah. And there's a few that stay the course, but a lot of them come in and out, and they last 6 months, maybe 1 year, and then they're done. How difficult is that world and that environment?
I think the fitness is a weird one, man, because it's such a polarizing topic. I have built everything I've ever built from what I've learnt and what I know works. The issue with that, it doesn't make you famous. It doesn't give you the allures of highlight reels you see on Instagram. 4 hour work week, I'm going to work 3 hours this week and make £1 million. Are you? Really? I've got a funny feeling, bruv. You've got a harsh reality of real online coaching. There's some people that can. I've got James Smith, prime example. I know him personally from uni, legend. And I remember when he was just starting, he came to Singapore. He's like, mate, why have you gone online? And I had this egotistical thing of, mate, I can't go online. I'm a coach. I've got to be one-on-one. I've got to save this person. Well, hang on a minute. Now I'm the opposite. People look at him and they're like, oh, yeah, he's got it easy. This dude is relentless. And he has been relentless for nearly 10 years. He's put on content every single day. He'll tell you the minute he's eating a fucking dodgy meal or going for a shit or whatever. My point, he is executed at the highest level for his business, and that's why he's so famous. Compared to people just see him on the, oh yeah, I could do that. Yeah. No, mate, you can't, because you're not willing to put the work in that respect. So yeah, like the people that go to David Lloyd, and they're not immersed in the subject. They're doing it for a quick fix of trying to figure out what they're trying to do.
What's the difference between the PTs that start and then they're successful and then they finish, and the biggest difference between ones that maybe try for 6 months, 12 months, and then it just doesn't work and they give up? Is it just that commitment, the discipline? Mm. Oh, and is it maybe it's just the right thing for some people and it's not for others? Like
mixture of both. I feel a good coach is curious. They want to know more. Because anybody says anything is finite to you, you know that they've got an opinion and they're biased. And if they're biased, it's not always going to work. So curiosity has always been the biggest driver for me. Is like, what's my next 1%? What can I next? You'll have this in training as well, when you're a gymnast or whatever, in any sport. It's like, what's the next? I've got one piece that I could do that's going to add, whether it's rugby, or it's practicing my passing, or for me, my job was tackling or turning over ball. I would just finish into the session and do 10 tackles on a bag and jackal, because it was repetition, it was reps. Most coaches lose desire to learn, and once they lose desire to learn and apply, it then becomes a conveyor belt of doing the same monotonous, because it is movement. There's 7 key movement patterns, whatever: push, pull, hinge, lunge, carry, twist, squat, like whatever. Like, how do you sexify that? Well, hang on, no. When you change somebody's life and they come to you and you see them, they've dropped. I've got one of my clients who dropped 40 kilos. Still with it. She's an absolute legend. But she couldn't unfortunately come to my wedding. But she would have come to my wedding.
Yeah.
The connections you build as a coach.
Yeah.
That's what keeps you in the game long enough. And there is a piece of the puzzle of like, how much money do you want to earn and how much impact do you want to have? Like, online for me was impact. You ask my wife, I work. I don't do this like this 2 hour day sitting there having a pina colada. I'm up at 6 this morning, working until 11, I'm going for a run, but I've got it all done, I get back and I'll finish. It's because I'm professional with that side of my life, as I was with my training. So that's why it's such a huge correlative effect of business. For me is now sport. Business is the contact sport, so you will get burnt. If you want to be an entrepreneur, if you want to build a business, you're going to get burnt. Don't pretend it's not going to be stressful. There's always going to be problems. If you want to grow and you're going somewhere you've never been before, put your helmet on and get after, because that's just going to be really tough. But it's the same with a sport. But if I do get to that level, what does that mean?
It's interesting, isn't it, mate? Because I think a lot of people now want to... Everyone wants to love what they do and be happy all the time. But I think what you need to look for, you need to find the thing that... The parts of it that you enjoy so much you can put up with the bits you don't like. Because there's a lot of what I do that I don't enjoy.
Yeah.
Like, when I sit down and, like, timestamp an episode, I like listening back to the episode, but that's 2 hours of... I like doing this bit.
Yeah.
I don't like necessarily sitting down doing all the planning order. That's a lot of work that goes into one episode. But I enjoy this part so much, I'm willing to do the other parts. I think that's what people maybe have to look for more, right?
100%. Like, we always say around, you've got to be willing to eat a shit sandwich. Like, work is work. If you took work away, that's a huge part of what a human being is. Is a human being is built to do stuff. Your creativity and the way you express yourself as a person comes through your part of your, you've got different areas of your life, but vocation. Living life on your terms doesn't mean work avoidance, because if it's work avoidance, it becomes monotonous, it becomes boring, and it becomes, what's the point?
Yeah.
Whereas the whole, I think my thing is always curiosity to explore, and it's the curiosity of the what if, but from a business standpoint, there is always going to be parts. I always refer back to training is like, there's parts of it. I hated doing, like, I love fitness because I was a fat kid, not because I like fitness. I was crap at fitness, but like the bleep test, but I would do it because it was part of the game.
Yeah.
The game that you're playing has, there has to be balance. There's good and bad. Do you have an opportunity to waver that? The more you grow, the more you have systems in place to do it now with like AI and stuff. But then you also have team. And then once you have team, you become the CEO. But then you see how many CEOs have got more than one company. It's because they're bored. My client, he sold Lazada, which is like Amazon. He sold it to Alibaba, which was a massive deal, like hundreds of millions, yeah? He was back to work within.
Yeah.
And I literally asked him, I was like, what are you doing? Like, you could do anything. And he goes, mate, it's not about the money.
Yeah.
It's the game. Yeah. And that taught me so much. On a Friday, he used to run sessions for free for entrepreneurs who didn't know what they were doing, and he would just literally break down this. In COVID, he rang me. He goes, "Oi, book a meeting with my PA. We're having a meeting. We're talking about your business," and it blew my mind.
Really?
This dude never. People think they can operate at a certain level, mate. Don't get it twisted. He had health problems. His health wasn't the best, but from a drive perspective, it was part of the game. He knew it was hard work, and he knew it was stressful, and he knew it was tough. But that's where the growth is. That's where the good bit is. The times you find that easy, you don't remember. The times that your wrist, you got a medal. It's not the medal. It's the feeling when you got off and you finished the routine.
You're right, mate.
And you know, and you're staring your coach in the eye and saying, well, you better not cry, bruv. But that is giving me goosebumps. It's such a powerful... That's what I find in my business especially is... I have days when I pull my hair out, man, every week. And I struggle. And I sometimes I'm stood there like, everyone says, oh, yeah... I've got a master to-do list system or procrastination or overwhelm. Man, do you know what? If you're actually doing this, that happens every day.
Yeah.
But the reward...
that's the bit people don't see, right?
People don't see.
They see James Smith now being very successful. They didn't see the 10 years like leading up to it. But it's the same with like your career. They see you making your professional debut. Mm. They don't see the 15 years leading up to it. That's like anything, right?
Anything, yeah.
And I think probably social media... it tricks young people into this illusion that you can get it quick, and it never works. I've sat down with so many elite athletes and people from different walks of life now, just on this podcast. There's just no trick. There's no magic. It's work consistently over a long period of time, and you might make it, but there's also a great chance you won't, you have to accept that. So find something you're willing to attack that if it doesn't work out, you'll go, do you know what? I'm glad I tried that. Like, I've learned a lot from it.
Well, can you... So my wife, for example, she didn't make Rio.
Yeah.
And then she was going for Commonwealths. Was living away from me. Da, 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 da. She missed Rio, whatever, by 0.1 or something. Similarly for Commonwealths. Done. Never talked about swimming. She still swims. So happy about her career. It took me a lot to ever talk about my career. I felt like I'd failed for ages. I just felt like I was a... I didn't want that in my life anymore. Rach is chilled. She left it all out on the table. I think so much can be said for actually putting... it's such a cliche thing to say. Look yourself in the mirror and say, have you actually done it?
Mm.
Are you actually... Or are you just being... Are you putting it on a facade for everybody else? Or are you looking at the highlight reel of Instagram? Instagram is the worst place to find inspiration, because what you do is you look at somebody you admire and you think, how the hell am I going to get there? They've got life so great. They've got so much money. Da-da-da-da-da. And they've got a whole content team. We're lucky enough to have your man in the corner who's doing our job. He would have 10 more blokes doing all that. Yeah?
Yeah.
We're at the forefront of growth, which we obviously want to take the likes of Sam with us and go, right, we want to go from whatever. I've got 50 online clients, I want 150, but I want a team and I want to do this and in-person days. It takes time. And you always overestimate how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
So underestimate. You're like, I'll do this in a year. You're doing a 10-year job in a year. Not going to happen, mate.
Yeah.
Whereas you go, okay, cool. What am I willing to do? I found this out last year. We grew our business by 300% in our first year. My second year, I was like, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do that again. Failed. Not because of me, I need a team. I can't take that much work on. It doesn't work that way. The way and I made some mistakes that were all on me. The pressure is a privilege. I'm driving this bus. Is it my fault? Yes. I've got an opportunity to correct it. Yes. The next bit.
Yeah.
People don't want that. People want, I want perfection now. Doesn't happen. And they're not willing to jump. There's an analogy of it. You know albatrosses, yeah? A big seagull bird. In the Galapagos Islands, it'll be on a come with me, stay with me. There's a hill. They'll lay the eggs on a cliff. When they're old enough, they'll just fly off, and then that chick will just jump. It hasn't got any idea what it's doing. It's either going to go splat or fly. It's the same thing with you within business or you leaving sport or anything, is that scary bit of like,
yeah,
I don't know if I'm going to die here. You've got to just, because the minute you jump, you figure it out.
Yeah.
You do it. It's the same thing. I find that really like, I teach a lot around leadership, not because I'm like, it's more, I'm leading myself, not like, he's the secret sauce for having a 100-person team. No, it's not. You've been a bellend and a role model. Are you fit? No, you're fat. Sort it out. That's more my style of leadership. So yeah, I think it is. It's people need to know what makes them tick, but also realize that it's okay to be you. You don't need to be somebody else.
Yeah.
Don't try and be. Nobody else would be James Smith. He's incredible. Like, as I said, as a coach, people get so jealous of him because they're like, oh, it's so easy for him. He will never tell you that he's like at the forefront of peak performance of fitness. He teaches overweight women how to lose weight, but he's very good at it.
Yeah.
And he's got a 50-man team behind him. So that it's the difference. Stop comparing yourself to him and compare to yourself from yesterday. That's what I would be looking at.
How do you find self-promotion, Will? Like, how do you find that up being online and putting yourself out there and saying, like, this is what I do?
Yeah.
Like, do you, has that been difficult for you, like, over time? So are you better with it now? Do you ever have moments where you feel like a bit of a fraud? Because I know that I do. And I'm saying this stuff, but does that creep in? And how do you battle that?
So when I first started PT, I filmed myself for a year. Face-to-face to camera, never put it, showed anybody. It is the most ugly film ever. It's really, really bad. But stuff like self-promotion is like playing an instrument. The more that you play it, the better you get. You can't expect to play Jimi Hendrix on the first day, yeah? So I used to, it comes into loads of different realms. Imposter syndrome, you get perfectionism, you wither away and you're not willing to do something, you procrastinate, you feel that you're overwhelmed and you find excuses. All this stuff usually is because you're judging yourself. The minute I flipped from I'm trying to impress everybody else to I'm putting my content out there to find my people that's going to solve their problems. And if I solve one person's problem that's willing to pay me, that person is worth the content, not the 250 people that are, I don't know, some robot or some little kid trolling me or whatever, which I don't really get that much. You callous yourself to it because it's you judging yourself. And coaches and athletes are the worst, because as soon as you got off those high bars, you would not focus on the 99% that went right. You'd focus on the 1% thing that you fucked up. Coaching's the same. Mm. Is you're like, oh man, I missed this one word. This is real life, man. Like, so? That little person who's desperate for your inspiration and you're not going to put your video out there because you're freaking out because your caption says the wrong word. Fuck that. Get it out there. The confidence needs feedback. The more feedback you get, the more confidence you'll have. But it starts with courage.
Yeah.
Courage to... I always said you've got to be naive enough to start and disciplined enough to endure.
You've
just got to be... I've posted every day for 4 years. I've got 3,500 followers. It's not a lot, but they're 3,500 people who want to listen to me.
Yeah.
Not, I need 1.5 million.
Yeah.
If, don't get it twisted, I wouldn't mind 1.5 million. But in that process, I want to affect 1.5 million. I play in the long game.
Do you think you'd find it, let's say you went from 3,500 to 1.5 million, do you think you'd be able to block that noise out? Because at 3,500, a few people shouting... So we had a video that went viral recently and there's a lot of people calling me a fucking clown.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Fine. I'm not... a lot of them are proper professional athletes as well. But I know what social media is. So for me, it's just... I find it quite funny.
Mm.
But I can block it out. Mm. If that happened to me 5 years ago,
a bit greed. Yeah, because it's an attack on you.
But then at 1.5 million, do you think you're... How do you think you'll react to that? Do you think it'd be absolutely fine? If all of a sudden that volume turned up,
if you gave me, if you went, if you, someone pressed the magic button, and I had all eyes on me and people started criticising me, my inner critic first would go fucking wild.
Yeah.
Because the fear of being found out, that's what imposter syndrome is. You feel like you're not adequate enough. Because I'm an emotional person, it's taking me a lot to regulate that.
Mm.
Am I perfect? No. Someone criticises me, I want to fuck them up, excuse my French, because that's my natural primitive chimp part of my brain. Is I'm the same with rugby, it's my inner monster, man. Someone starts with me, it's game over. It was my problem. I would have played higher if I didn't have that, but right, I also wouldn't have got as high if I didn't have it.
Yeah. It's like a two sides of a coin.
Yeah. But yeah, I would struggle with being accepted because I have that, like, I'm achievement driven as a motivator, but as a society, I want to be. I've always wanted to not be that fat kid who just everyone loves.
Yeah. But maybe everything you went through in your rugby career means that, because for me, when I was younger, I used to think, right, I'm going to do my gymnastics career, go to the Olympics, win a gold medal, and that's the most important thing I'll ever do in my life.
Done.
My life's done. Everything after that will be easy. It'll be a bit boring, which is mad. But now I go, well, that chapter prepared me for this one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take all those lessons into the next chapter of my life.
Sure.
And I'm more excited. This is going to be even better.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make less mistakes.
For different reasons.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that will happen one day. You know, you might get to 1.5 million and hopefully everything you've learned through that will mean you're in the right place to handle that. I think the worst thing that can happen for people is they go from 3,500 to 1.5 million in a week at the age of 20.
The worst,
and then
mate.
Whereas now you've had enough life that you're
And I've also got enough stuff
outside of it
to keep me grounded.
You're having a son, right?
Yeah. So I'm like...
I don't know what you're having.
Yeah,
you're having a son.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah,
massive head.
He's going to come.
I just remembered we were at the scan and she was showing the baby, and obviously it was the umbilical cord, and I was like, oh yeah, that's his massive piece, and they were like, shut up, you idiot, should I be serious? Sorry, I'm going off tangent. My thing for me, so I've got connection over consumption always, and I value, I'd much rather have a client especially for longer than, I don't do 12 week six packs, I don't do like quick detoxes unless they're like pre-diabetic or something. I think everything's about growth and everything's about getting it. And for me, it's mastering my own skills. Mastering a skill of mine is not to give a fuck if that happened.
Hmm.
Whereas I would, I remember I had a picture, I was doing body fat test to one of my clients, but it was all staged for Instagram. And it was a poor photo of doing it. I was basically, you're supposed to pinch with your hand and grab it with calipers. It doesn't see my hands. It looks like I'm just grabbing with calipers. I got rinsed by one of my mentors. Fucking hell, man. I was apologising to this dude. And he's laughing. He's like, shut up, you dick. It's just whatever. But that was my... Yeah. I have to be accepted. That this was like when I was in Singapore.
Yeah.
Would that happen now? Instagram to me now is a game. It's a shop window.
Yeah,
but
you've been able to take the emotion away from it. You see it for what it is. What that is. I know the devil I'm dealing with. I think as long as you... And then for me, I'm like, as long as I'm authentic...
Massive.
And I stick to that... then I don't feel I'm then doing any damage to somebody that's coming up that doesn't understand that yet and they've not learned that. I'm not just chatting waffle
and pretending
you know, selling something that I don't actually believe in.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing.
As long as I stick to that.
Instagram is the least authentic place you can be because you're doing something to show people stuff. But if you're doing it with your values, it is. That's the difference, like you said. You doing a video and doing it differently because it goes viral doesn't make it authentic. It means you've got the algorithm. But if that message is to help somebody, because you know full well if they get in the door, they can help. You see, I do this with coaches who this big imposter syndrome thing is, I chase the algorithm. I'm like, yeah, but you put it on your terms.
Yeah.
Same thing for you. It's like if James Smith, again, we keep using him, but it's because he's been very successful. He is not the same person on Instagram as he is if you were to have a beer with him.
Mm.
But that's because he puts his mask on and gets that.
Yeah.
All amazing celebrities in relation to performers put on the mask to be who they need to be at that moment. It's the same with Instagram. If you're doing it towards your audience to, if they prefer a reel over a Canva caption, for example, that's fine.
Yeah.
Because that's what the market wants. But you're doing it on your terms.
Yeah, you have to do it. You can't change for them. You can't change.
Oh, mate, do you know what? Here's some branched-chain amino acids that I've got a green tea extract in. Tell someone they can lose 30 kilos in a day with it. But you'll get a million views.
Yeah.
You have a choice. Me, no, because I've worked 16 years to fuck that off.
Yeah,
people don't. It's that's what young coaches are getting. They're like, they see that as fame, where actually you putting your message and doing stuff like this, which is long form, gives context. With context comes freedom, because people have choice. That's the issue. It's such a this issue of TikTok.
Yeah,
is 90% of people use TikTok as a distraction. Whereas if, like you said, we talked earlier about pregnancy, weird. We've got 10 people in this class. Everyone's like, yeah, I saw it on TikTok. And I'm like, what? Yeah, I saw something on Instagram. But it's modern day society
it
now.
It is, mate, yeah.
But you're using it in the right way.
But I think for people out there, it's interesting to hear that from someone like you, and probably me, is that the smart people that understand it don't use it in the way you're using it.
Yeah.
So think, why are they doing it? Ask the question, why are billionaires not letting their kids on social media? There's a reason.
There's a reason.
Think about that. It's probably because it's not good for you.
No.
Amazing.
It is such a weird, weird piece of the puzzle. Like, there's a huge, I had an argument the other day around, like, you, as someone like me, not using their phone. I'm like, but I run my whole business on my phone.
Mm.
So what am I going to do? Not have a phone?
Yeah.
It's not. My standards are, that goes off when I'm with my family, especially when I've got a kid coming, is that it needs to be in a different room, because as soon as someone's got a problem, I've got to solve it, because that's what my identity is. Well, actually, no. They got broccoli problems, bruv. That can happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's huge.
You've got to know the devil you're dealing with.
Yeah, you've got to accept there's trade-offs. One of my friends, we did a talk around leadership, and someone asked him that she was growing her coaching business at a rate that was too fast. She'd gone from nothing to like 20K in a month. And she was like, I need, for me to sustain this, I've got to become and do something that I'm not sure I'm willing to do. She's got a kid. And he said, his name's Joe Parrish, legend. People should follow him. He's a very clever dude. He said, what are you willing to regret? Massive.
Mm.
Because if you want to build a business, you're going to have to work. But you're going to have to work. You're not going to see your kid as much. Yeah, so what are you willing? Me and Rach have got a relationship where she knows the crack. We've designed the way that we work to, when I'm in, I'm absolutely all in, focused in. When I'm out, I'm doing it because it's the only way we can, as a family. I think people get such like caught up in the, what should I be doing? What I always ask, what I know I shouldn't be doing, and what am I willing not to do? Like, I have to train every day.
Mm.
Not because I'm a meathead. I'm not like walking in like Peter Andre. I'm a strong athlete who I want to be good at jiu-jitsu, but it's to train my monster, man.
Yeah.
It makes me regulated. It means I can be calm and be calm and not be itching and just be. It's because it's my inner critic. My inner critic saying, you little fat little bastard, you've got to move. I don't mean it like that. It keeps me sharp.
It's great that you know that about yourself, honey. And I think that's probably one thing I've taken away from this, how you like that self-awareness of, right, I have got this inner aggression in me. I need to control it and use it in the right way. I think that's massive.
The biggest thing I've learned from the age of now to 34 is I need to know more about
and
me.
And I think a lot of people have that as well, so they're going to find that really valuable. Will, mate, this conversation's been brilliant.
No, thank you very
sure
much for having me, man.
I'm sure we could do it again for sure. And all the best with the baby, mate.
Give me a text about what happens, just so I know what goes on, mate, because it's happening just
compare head sizes.
Yeah, mate, you're buying me massive.
All the best, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, mate. It's been awesome.